Thank you very much for the introduction. And again, Clive and Colin, thank you for the opportunity to participate in this important conference. What I'd like to do today during my presentation is talk about the United States counter-terrorist financing strategy directed at ISIS. And my thesis can be summarized in 4 points. Very simply, ISIS is the most well-funded terrorist organization in history. It's been estimated to have an annual budget. I've looked at figures that estimate the annual budget between $1 and $2 billion a year. Whatever figure is ultimately the correct figure, whether it's $1 billion or $2 billion, nonetheless, it's very large. Second, I believe that like the Al-Qaeda counterterrorist financing strategy, going after the money is critical for reasons that have been discussed by other panelists here today. It's important to disrupting terrorist-related activities. It's important with respect to identifying important intelligence information that would identify members of the ISIS financial network. It's important as a deterrent effect to those that may be seeking or thinking about providing money in support of ISIS goals and objectives. And actually, even last week, it was highlighted by General John Allen, who is President Obama's lead person in charge of ISIS, the U.S. government's counterterrorist financing activities involving ISIS. He stated in an address that he gave last week in New York City that going after the money of ISIS was a central component of the U.S. government's counterterrorist financing strategy. The third point of my thesis is that the U.S.'s efforts have been dismal. It's been an ineffective strategy. It hasn't worked. And therefore, the last point is that it needs to be revised, it needs to be refocused, it needs to be targeted, retargeted, and made more comprehensive, and perhaps resembling something similar to the economic sanction strategy that has been implemented by the United States against Iran, and that I think has been largely responsible, I say largely, not totally, but largely responsible for causing Iran to come to the negotiating table and to agree to enter into this Iran nuclear agreement to reduce its nuclear ambitions and nuclear goals. Now, why do I say that the strategy has been ineffective? Well, last November, I was invited by the U.S. House of Representatives a Committee on Financial Services to testify regarding the sources of funding of ISIS. And it was the first congressional hearing held on the subject. And so in preparation for my testimony, I did some research on the subject. And I was stunned to learn that first and foremost, that Executive Order 13224 remains the centerpiece of the U.S.'s counterterrorist financing strategy. And of course, Executive Order 13224 was the executive order that was signed by President George W. Bush in September of 2001 to go after the financing of Al-Qaeda. So I thought, well, you know, there's got to be some new executive order going after ISIS, some new legislation, executive order, something new with respect to ISIS. And no, and I learned that it was Executive Order 13224. So then I looked at the underlying designations. And said, well, you know, there's got to be a number of designations under that executive order. And I learned that, in fact, there were about, I think, less than a dozen. And that was last November. But there were approximately less than a dozen designations. And I know that when I left the Treasury Department in 2003, I think we had over 300 designations and in less than 2 years under Executive Order 13224 directed at Al-Qaeda. And, and even more alarming was that with respect to these 12 designations, there was only one that dealt with terrorist financing. The other 10 or 11 designations, basically, the Treasury Department had designated terrorist fighters, some senior terrorist military officials. And therefore, if they had any assets in the United States, they had to be blocked. Guess what? I don't think senior leaders, military leaders of ISIS have many bank accounts in the United States for blocking. And further, under Executive Order 13224, U.S. persons are prohibited from doing business with senior leaders, military leaders of ISIS. And again, I doubt that there are many such transactions and business-related negotiations going on with such individuals. And in preparation for my talk today, I went back and looked at designations under the executive order since, over the last 11 months, and they are not all that impressive. And so I'm wondering, what's going on? I mean, there seems to be a disconnect with what the administration is saying. You know, going after the funding is critical. Going after the funding is essential. We need to disrupt the funding of ISIS and reality, you know, the results, the effectiveness. There's a dramatic disconnect. And so it seems to me that as a result of this disconnect, the strategy needs to be reexamined and revised. And it's no secret that there are at least four, and I probably should add a fifth, a principal source of funding for ISIS, and those include the illicit sale of oil, which has been estimated to be as much as approximately $1 million a day, as high as $40 million a month, a lot of money. And as you know, ISIS controls territories in Iraq and Syria collectively. They're about the size of Belgium, significant geographic area. They control the natural resources within those territories, including oil refineries, oil production plants. And these refineries are producing approximately 50,000 barrels of oil a day, approximately $1 million a day. Now, in fairness, not all of that money is going to the sale of oil on the black market. A lot of the oil that's produced from these refineries is being used by the people in the territories that are controlled by ISIS. But even if it's a small percentage, it's still a lot of money. I mean, it's still in the hundreds of millions of dollars a year just from that stream of funding. And then you add to that extortion and illicit taxation, which we know that ISIS is imposing extortionate taxes on virtually everything in the territories that it controls. Agriculture, traveling on the roads, you got to pay a tax. Money withdrawn from bank accounts, you have to pay a tax to ISIS. Salaries, you have to pay a tax to ISIS. I mean, virtually they've taxed everything, every type of commercial activity in the territories they control. And then the third source is sale of ancient artifacts in Iraq and Syria. The exact number, again, it's quite speculative, but again, it's estimated to be in the tens of millions of dollars annually. And then kidnappings for ransom, we've all heard about that. It's been estimated to be, in 2014 alone, to have generated as much as $20 million for ISIS. And then the fifth category that I should have added should have been looting banks, because ISIS has looted within the territories it controls approximately, I think there's something like 90 Iraqi bank branches that are located in the territories in Iraq controlled by ISIS. They've looted the state banks. The private banks, they haven't taken those monies, but again, they're taxing the withdrawals of funds from the bank customers from those bank accounts. And then I think in Syria, there are as many as 20 or more different financial institutions whose monies have been looted by ISIS. So if you think about it and you put this in perspective, You add all of this up annually, and these are monies that bin Laden could have only dreamed of, you know, having this amount of money annually to finance terrorist-related activities. There is a very important fundamental distinction difference between al-Qaeda funding and ISIS funding. Al-Qaeda was funded principally from external sources. Okay? It received monies from corrupt charities. It received monies from deep-pocket donors. It received monies from sympathetic states, you know, members of the Saudi royal family that were sympathetic. You know, for example, members of the Saudi royal family that were sympathetic to al-Qaeda's causes. But again, the money was coming into al-Qaeda from various external sources. In contrast, the legal response in the U.S. was Executive Order 13224. And here's what it authorizes. It authorizes the Secretary of the Treasury, in consultation with the Secretary of State and the Attorney General, to designate and block the property of foreign nationals who act for on behalf of or owned or controlled by al-Qaeda or terrorist organizations associated with al-Qaeda. I don't think there's too many of those that we could apply to ISIS, you know, people that are individuals or entities in the United States that act for on behalf of or owned or controlled by ISIS. But it's the same authority that's being applied to ISIS. Second category for designation, people that assist in, sponsor, provide financial, material, or technological support. Perhaps here, yes. This is where the executive order would have application with respect to ISIS. And then finally, persons that are otherwise associated with the specially designated global terrorists that are placed on the EO list. And then state has a role in this. They can designate persons for making or receiving contributions of funds, goods, or services for the benefit of. I mean, this is another category for designation under the executive order. And then the Secretary of State has the authority to designate persons who pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism that threaten U.S. national security. It seems to me, then, when we look at Executive Order 13224, its success depends upon designated financial supporters and facilitators possessing assets in the United States for blocking, because it has no legal effect outside of the United States in terms of blocking of assets. And again, I would question whether or not there are many assets that are linked to ISIS that are located in the United States, bank accounts or other assets that are located in the United States. And likewise, success under the executive order depends upon identifying individuals, or prohibits U.S. nationals from engaging in financial transactions with members of ISIS. I'm trying to understand, you know, why these dismal numbers, why the ineffectiveness of the strategy. We know that Omar al-Baghdadi broke away from al-Qaeda, I think it was in February of 2014. And so they have been a separate entity for approximately 20 months. And during that 20-month period of time, having maybe two dozen designations is shocking. So I'm trying to figure out, you know, what the reason, what the explanation is. And by the way, I'm not alone in my concerns about stopping the flow of money to ISIS. In fact, on October 10th of this month, the New York Times published an editorial, and the title of the editorial is "Why Is Money Still Flowing to ISIS?" This is the New York Times editorial board. Again, it's dated October 10, 2015. And the first statement, interesting. Videos of Islamic State fighters driving brand name SUVs and pickup trucks in Syria, Iraq, and Libya are graphic proof that efforts to squeeze the group financially have not done nearly enough. That's the first statement in the op-ed piece. And then I thought one other statement in the op-ed piece was interesting, and it states, last week, it's been the first week of this month, The State Department offered a reward of up to $5 million for information that leads to the significant disruption of sales of oil or antiquities benefiting the group. And so the State Department's offering this big reward, $5 million. Tell us what you know about the sale of ISIS oil in the black market, which conversely tells me that the State Department doesn't know. They don't know where how this is happening. And therefore, they're at a loss to understand the flows of money going to ISIS. So the problem. So what's a recommendation? Perhaps we need to have a sanctions regime that is similar to the Iranian sanctions regime. Why? Because I think that ISIS is state-like, and state sanctions, I think, should be imposed upon a de facto state. Why do I say it's state-like? It controls territory. That's certainly a characteristic of a state. It controls the people within that territory. That's a characteristic of a state. It governs and regulates their activity. That's a characteristic of the state. And while it's a criminal de facto state, I think nonetheless, and of course it controls all the resources within that state, and even though it's an illegal criminal de facto state, I think it's nonetheless state-like. The Iranian sanctions became effective. I mean, they've been in existence, as you know, going back to 1979 with the overthrow of the Shah of Iran and the attack on the U.S. Embassy, the taking of embassy workers as hostages. This was going back to President Jimmy Carter. But I think that they became most effective in President Obama's first term in office. He has issued, I think, no less than 6 or 7, maybe even more, separate executive orders against Iran in his two terms in office. And perhaps the most significant deals with secondary boycotts. So, of course, U.S. persons are prohibited from exporting or importing goods to or from Iran. That's the primary boycott. But in addition, foreign businesses that maybe have no or doing no or very little business with the United States are equally prohibited from doing business with Iran, and specific sectors of Iran, including the industry sector, financial sector, the shipping sector, and other businesses. And if they do, then what ends up happening is at least now 5 of 12 listed sanctions must be imposed against those individuals. And I'm not going to go over these, but I'm just going to list them. These are the sanctions that were applicable, that have been applicable against Iran. Denial of licenses for U.S. export or military useful technology, denial of U.S. bank loans, denial of export-import bank loans, credit guarantees, ban on procurement contracts with the U.S. government, prohibition on transactions in foreign exchange, and so on and so forth. And so my point is this. These sanctions are comprehensive, very comprehensive. They're very focused. And these sanctions have been directed against specific industries that were facilitating and enabling Iran to develop its oil industry, that were contributing directly or indirectly with Iran's ability to develop its nuclear technology, that again is believed to have intended to be used for military purposes. And I wonder then if the ISIS sanctions shouldn't look more like the Iranian sanctions. While even if we could argue that, well, legally doing business, we could use the Executive Order 13224 to prohibit foreign businesses in some way, limit their ability to provide parts and services, equipment needed to develop the oil refineries that are controlled by ISIS in Iraq and Iran. I think that a more nuanced, a more focused sanctions regime like the Iranian sanctions that is going to put these industries, foreign companies, on notice that if you do business with ISIS or entities controlled by ISIS that enable ISIS to generate revenues, then these are the types of sanctions that will be issued against you and the price that you will have to pay. I don't know if it's the panacea, but I do certainly believe that something beyond what is currently being employed by the U.S. government needs to be done. If we continue down the same path, I think we're likely to see the same results, which are very dismal results, and we're likely to see ISIS continue to expand into other countries, into other territories. We're likely to see ISIS continue with the brutality, the horrific brutality that we've seen employed by ISIS fighters against civilians over the last 20 months or so. So with that, I'll just conclude, and hopefully during the Q&A session, I would be very interested to hear your response, your suggestions with respect to how this sanctions regime can be more effectively implemented. So with that, thank you. Thank you very much.